You're listening to a special ad-free episode of PDXPodcast.com. I'm Gregory Day. Thanks for tuning in.
Today we chat with Colin Blunstone of the legendary British psychedelic band The Zombies. They'll be playing a set at Revolution Hall September 17th and promise to take audiences on a journey through time, from their early hits to solo favourites and tracks from their latest album, Still Got That Hunger. Let's catch up with Colin via telephone from the UK right now.
Good to talk to you. Yeah, we're leaving for the, well, Rod and I are leaving for the West Coast actually on Monday. And I know we're coming up to Portland, so really looking forward to it.
I understand that you may be playing a few cover songs. Is that right?
Well, we may. Yes, we may. They might be as much a surprise to me as they are to you, because the way things have developed with the band, we don't live very close to one another anymore, whereas we used to. And so I'm never quite sure what's happening until we get back together again. So, it should be interesting.
You know, I was listening to some of your solo work again, and I forgot how emotional, though you were far away, that track really is. Does that track have more meaning to you as you've aged?
Well, it is a very emotional song. It was arranged by a wonderful string arranger called Chris Gunning. And what we did on that album, On the Air Tonight, it's a re-record. It was recorded with a string quartet in the early 70s. But we just played it on piano. And of course, that originally, Chris Gunning, who did the arrangement, is a pianist. And that's how I first heard it. And in some ways, I prefer it with just piano, because it's a very, very dramatic and an unusual arrangement. I think it's incredible. And we played that live. The keyboard player in my band is called Pete Billington. He's a wonderful player. And we played that live. And that's my favorite track on that album. Definitely.
Me too. Yes. I really felt so much emotion listening to that song. It worked for me on different levels. I mean, people who passed on in my life, and you know, long distance love. I think I can relate to that on many different levels. And your vocal performance is even more emotional, I think, after all these years. Also, I saw an interview with you, and you talked about your Storytellers show at the Moody Blues Cruise. Now, I did some digging on YouTube. And you're quite the comedian on stage.
You know, we do tailor the show to the venue and to the kind of show we're playing. And those storyteller shows, there's just the two of us. It's just Rod and me. So we will reminisce and tell stories in a way that we wouldn't do when it's a full band show. So it's more intimate and. I think it works better that way. Well, in fact, we have got a show, a two-man performance at the end of this tour. We're playing the Ace Hotel in Palm Springs, and that's just going to be an acoustic duo. But I mean, we have quite an open idea about all this, in that that show was booked as an acoustic duo show, but the first time I knew was when I was given a list of where we're playing, and it just mentioned, sort of in brackets, oh, this is just an acoustic duo show. So we'll have to have a think about that. It's a somewhat spontaneous performance, and it's not particularly set in stone. We have a pretty good idea what songs we're going to sing, but...
Right.
What interests me in the duo things is that often the intros sound very different when it's just a piano. It could actually be a completely different intro. You know, if it's a guitar-based intro, then hearing it on piano, it will be totally different. Now, if you couple that with the fact that Rod has a habit of skipping songs when we're playing, he sometimes misses out a song. And so this leaves me in a pissed position where it's happened that he's gone to not the next song on the set list, but the next one. Plus, he's playing a piano intro that I wouldn't have recognized anyway.
Yeah, what's your cue?
It's an added edge to when we do acoustic shows that sometimes I have no idea what the song is until the second I come in. And up till now, I've always got it. But sometimes it's very close. It's right the second that I start singing. I know what this is.
He must know this. He must know this, right? I mean, he must be able to go.
He does know that, but he just sometimes has a habit of skipping. It's just that neither of our eyesight's as good as it was. You just misread the set list and start playing the wrong song. It's easily, much more easily done than you would think.
Wow. Okay. Well, and, now we know.
To me, it's just an added edge of danger. And the thing is that if I don't know what's going on, I can always stop it. There's only two of us. I just say, stop.
Right.
I'm going to tell a story.
Yes, and you did tell a funny story about your frustration getting Time of the Season, the vocals together. A bit of frustration there. But you had the crowd cracking up. It's a very funny story.
Oh, right. Yes, I remember it vividly. It's one of my vivid memories from recording Odyssey and Oracle. The song was finished in the morning. It was the last song that was written for the album, and it's the last song we recorded. It was finished in the morning, and we were in Studio 3 in Abbey Road in the afternoon. And there's no way I could have really known that song well, because it had only just been written. And so it was a bit challenging. And, well, you know the story because you heard me say it, that Rob was trying to coach me through the headphones. And the thing that makes me laugh is it wasn't just him and me. I mean, there was the engineer, the assistant engineer, various other Abbey Road people there, all the band, and they can all hear this. And we're screaming at one another with probably extremely bad language. And at the same time, I'm trying to get together. It's the Time of the Season for Loving. And it always makes me chuckle that we were screaming at one another while we were doing this.
I love it, the juxtaposition there. A couple years back, you played South by Southwest, and I understand that Bill Murray admitted to being a big fan and visited you backstage. Is that correct?
We did, actually. We did. I mean, he was there for, 40 minutes, 45 minutes or something like that. It was great having a chat to him. I think he's really into music, I got that feeling from him.
Yes.
That he is a real diehard fan of music. And I think he was very interested to come backstage and have a chat and just see how it all works. I mean, I'm sure he went on and saw other bands as well. He didn't just come to see us. But I was extremely flattered and very excited that he came backstage. We've been really fortunate, especially in our later career. I think there was quite a few things that could have gone better for us in the 60s. That's the same as all bands. But in our later career, we've been really fortunate. We've also had songs in a lot of films and commercials as well. I can't really rattle them all off to you, but
I've heard them.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like having a hit record. When you have a record used in a commercial or a film, it just introduces you to a whole new area of people, new strata of people.
Right.
And it just, right. Of course, it incredibly adds to your profile and helps you, when you're touring.
Now, this is going back a bit, but I think Rod said something about when you first came to the States, you played a New York show and... It was very cold. You were 19 years old, and there were gunshots going off. Is that right?
That is right. I wasn't involved in the gunshots, but Chris White and Hugh Grundy were. I think it was on New Year's Eve, and it was in or near Times Square, and someone was shot. And in actual fact, I mean, it was obviously very dramatic.
It doesn't happen in the UK, that's for sure. Not very often.
I mean, it certainly didn't happen then, and it doesn't happen very often here. But, I mean, I remember that time when we came to New York, and when we were going through immigration, that's the first time I saw an immigration officer with a gun.
Yeah, and, shocking. It's really shocking.
That was a big deal to me. I'd never seen a gun before, you know.
Now, did Patti LaBelle, did she introduce you to Aretha Franklin or just the music? Or?
Well, when Rod said that, we couldn't leave the theater, so that we weren't going to go out and meet people. But what she said is, you've got to check out Aretha Franklin and also Nina Simone. I remember her saying Nina Simone. And we absolutely did, and we got everything we could on both of those singers. There was a great feeling of camaraderie backstage because we opened on Christmas Day. Mm-hmm. So even the American artists who were there didn't get home much over that Christmas.
Right.
And of course, we certainly didn't. We were playing, six shows a day, but we only played one or two songs. There were 15 acts on the bill. It was kind of the tradition of how shows were in those days. And but it meant we had to stay there. And there were huge crowds outside, and Paul Atkinson, our guitarist, was the only guy who ventured out during the day, and he had his shirt ripped off him, and he was pushed up against a plate glass window, and the police came and got him out, but they said to him, we'll do this once, but we're not doing it again. So after that, we just had to stay in the theater. Well, it was just, I think it's just a weight of bodies, There were hundreds or possibly even thousands of people outside the theater. And, there was such huge interest in all the artists that were there that the people just moved forward and you get trapped.
Right.
So we had to wait until the show had finished. And everyone had gone home. And it's funny because when we came out, there was no one there. Whereas during the day, there were thousands of people there.
You have this incredible voice, and I understand that you do an hour's worth of vocal warm-ups before each show. Is that correct?
I do half an hour before soundcheck and half an hour before the show.
Right.
So that would be the usual thing that I would do. And I think it really helps. I mean, I've heard singers come off stage and say, once we got into the fifth song, my voice had really warmed up and it was really great. And I just think, well, why not warm up before you go on stage and then it'll be good from the first song.
Right. And what does that involve, your warm up? Do you just go through scales?
It's vocal exercises. So, I've got them on my phone. I've got them on a CD. So one way or another, I will just wander around backstage looking a little strange. Mostly they're like scales, yeah. Oh. Just going through these exercises. I think there are about 12 or 14 exercises that I do. And they all go quite high, so it's sort of, it helps me because a lot of the songs that we perform are quite rangy, so you need to have that range. From, we used to open on a song called I Love You, which was written by the Zombies bass player, but was actually a hit for an American band called People, and it has a top B in it, and that was our first song, and a top B in a male voice is quite high.
Mm-hmm.
And so your voice needs to be warmed up, otherwise you can't sing that note.
Right, no, you gotta run away from people who start coughing too.
Well, that's another thing. It's a constant concern.
I run away. If I hear a cough, I'm running away.
Well, me too. If I can. I mean, sometimes backstage it's not that easy if it's a small room with a lot of people in it. But coughing and sneezing.
Yes.
But I've got a theory that if you're really
stay home.
Stay up, yeah. Oh, you'd be amazed. People come up to me, they've done it quite recently, and said, you know, I'm so glad. It's backstage, you know. I'm so glad I can make the show today. I'm just getting over laryngitis. I didn't think I could come to the show. I say, you know, look, just keep your distance. Is it wise to be talking to me? You know, if either you've got a heavy cold or laryngitis or something, it's crazy.
It's awful.
Because if I get a bad cold, there's a chance I won't be able to do the show.
And that
all gets a bit scary. But I've got a slight theory that if you really pay attention, people kind of go a bit, they move their head backwards before they sneeze, or especially sneezing. They kind of just go back a bit before they sneeze. You've got to be quick. And of course, if there's lots of people around you, you might miss it. But I've got a theory that at least some of the time you can spot it when someone's going to cough or sneeze.
I'll keep an eye out. I'll keep an eye out.
I know. Well, it is worth it, because sometimes you will. And I mean, there's a more obvious one where people are struggling to keep a cough or a sneeze in, mm-hmm. and you know, if you're on the lookout, you'll spot it.
Right, know? Right. Well, briefly, I'd like to touch on the last album, "Chasing the Past." I'm curious the inspiration for that song. It's my favorite track on the album.
I think it's a brilliant song. I mean, I didn't write it. Rod wrote that. I interpret it as you know, pretty. It seems pretty obvious that it's just looking to the future, really. Obviously, Rod could tell you if there's a more specific storyline behind it. But I think it does sum up the band very well, because although we're very happy, really enjoy playing the old classic hits and to, you know, acknowledge our past repertoire, many of those songs we only ever played in the studio. And so it's been great for us to, in our own way, rediscover these songs. It's been a great journey. But for all of us, it's vital that we're writing and recording new material. And I think that's the essence of that lyric.
Wonderful.
It's a really good song, you know, and that album, strangely enough, I've still got that hunger. We recorded with the same technique, if you like, as Odyssey and Oracle. With Odyssey and Oracle, we had a very restricted budget, and we were recording in probably the most expensive studio, certainly in England, if not at the time, maybe the world, Abbey Road. So to get round the fact that we had such a minuscule budget, we rehearsed really extensively before we recorded that album, so that when we went into the studio, we knew the song, we knew the arrangement, where the keys were set, and we were just looking for a performance. And we did the same thing with Still Got That Hunger. We rehearsed extensively, and to a large extent, that album is recorded live. All the backing tracks, all the solos,
right,
and all the lead vocals were recorded live. Only the backing vocals were put on afterwards.
Right.
So, and you know, we really enjoyed recording like that. I hope, and we, you know, we'll probably start recording another album next year, and I really hope that we can record in the same way. We use a specific studio in Richmond, which is in the west of London, which was set up really well for recording live, so that we were in separate rooms, but we had good eye lines to each other, so we could all see one another.
Right,
but there
very
was
important
separation.
You know, Judas Priest did the same thing on their latest album. It's really interesting.
Mm.
Another story that you told at the Storyteller Show, which I love, by the way, it was about your first recording session, and the engineer was a bit, how shall we say, inebriated. Do you remember
this
story?
I remember it very well. He was absolutely paralytic. It was fashionable in those days to record late. Some people would record through the night, but we would start at about 7, and we would go on till late, maybe midnight, 1 o'clock or something like that. And unfortunately, this engineer, who was a very good engineer, but he'd been to a wedding all day, and now we were starting at 7 o'clock, and it was obvious that he was drunk from the beginning. But the real problem was that he was very aggressive with it. And what makes me laugh is that I was just to myself, I was after about 20 minutes in the studio with this guy screaming down the headphones at me and everyone else. After 20 minutes in the studio, I thought, I don't think this is for me. This whole recording thing, it's not for me. And it makes me laugh because here I've been recording for over 50 years. But I was convinced at that point that this wasn't going to last. But, and then I probably said in the story that we had a bit of luck and he collapsed. And we carried him out. And we carried him up 2 flights of stairs and put him in a black London taxi. And I never saw him again. And his assistant took over. And this is the interesting thing, really. His assistant was Gus Dudgeon. And that was Gus Dudgeon's first session, and it was our first session. And Gus went on to produce all of Elton's early albums, Kiki Dee, David Bowie, many, many huge artists, but specifically Elton. I think he recorded the first 7 or 8 Elton albums. And he always remembered that Zombies session was his first session.
Right, wow. Wow, I didn't hear the rest of that story. That's wonderful.
About the Gus Dudgeon.
Right, no.
I may not have said it at the time. Those are not rehearsed, those stories. You're just making them up, you know, as you go along.
Just a couple of silly questions here. You talk about being polite. You're very English, you're very polite. Now, England's changing, isn't it? Is England becoming less polite? I'm an expat myself, so I'm curious your take.
I think in some areas it possibly is. I don't think we're so good at queuing as we used to be. and I can remember I was brought up to go, went into a shop, I was brought up to say, excuse me, if it's not too much trouble, I wonder if you could, if you were to say that in a shop now, they've gone, you know.
It doesn't work in the States either. It doesn't work in the USA.
No, I didn't want to say that, but it wouldn't work in the States either.
I've actually had to learn to be ruder.
Well, you have to be more direct, don't you?
That's
in America,
sure, yes.
I think you say, give me the salt and pepper. Give me this. Give me that. When I was brought up, it makes me laugh now. So salt and pepper, I would say, excuse me, if it's not too much trouble, I was wondering if you could pass me the salt and pepper. Oh, bloody hell, your food's gone cold by the time you get the salt and pepper.
Well, the world is moving faster, so I think that has something to do with it. Yes, I'm going to wrap it up, but I do think it's inevitable that you will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They're sort of teasing you with all these nominations, but it seems to be...
I know, they're merciless, aren't they? They're merciless.
I mean, it must be exciting to be nominated, right?
It's incredibly exciting to be nominated, and I think it's a sort of... It validates what we've been doing all these years. And I think it's a real thrill that we've been nominated three times. I think that's fantastic.
Is that a record? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. I have a feeling there are bands that have been nominated, you know, considerably more than that. But it would be wonderful to be inducted if it happens. But if it doesn't, I still feel that it's very exciting that we've been nominated 3 times.
Thank you so much, Colin. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Cheers. Well, it's been great talking to you. All the very best.
All right. Cheers.
Okay.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Today's show was produced and edited by Gregory Day, that's me. If you'd like to contact me directly, you can reach me at greg@pdxpodcast.com. We'll be back with Johnny Marr in just a few days. Make sure to tune in for that. I can't wait.